So next we're going to hear from Ivan Baxter, who's with USDARS, who's located at the Donald Danforth Center. He's going to talk in general about ionomics and plant seeds.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming out for this great session. It's kind of good to follow on a bunch of different crops. I'm going to be telling you a little bit about sort of how we think of the nutrient content of crops from an ionomics perspective, or thinking of it in terms of all of the elemental nutrients that we can measure with ICP mass spec. And so when we, this term that I'm using is the ionome, or all of the inorganic ions within a cell tissue or organism, and the reason we talk about that as a whole is that that we measure it all on one instrument, and so each sample is a single data point for us, and then also just because there's a lot of interactions between these elemental nutrients, and so we tend to think of it more holistically and less as individual traits, as you may have heard it talked about in the earlier talks. So why do we care? Obviously, for this session, I don't have to go into that. It's an important nutrient for what we eat. But more also, it's also a reflection of what's going on in the environment and in the plant, and I'll talk about that in a little later. We, in my lab, have set up this ionomics pipeline, which is shown in sort of cartoon form here. It mostly starts with field-grown tissues. We have lots of great collaborators who send us sample. Mostly we're doing soybeans and corn, and then when we do large seeded species, we have a seed weighing robot that we use. We also have a leaf punch, or we just weigh samples into a tube if we're doing smaller seeded crops or leaves. Once we have the sample in the tube, we throw it in a little bit of hot nitric acid, and that digests away all of the stuff that we're not interested in, since then you're left with the elements in solution, and you transfer that to 96 well plates, which then go on our conductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer that can run 576 samples every time we turn the machine on. That takes about a day and a half. We do that three times a week, and we get 20 elements out of that. So that's the crank we turn, and we've been cranking and cranking and cranking over the last 6 years. And we're now over 250,000 samples that we've run. And that is the underlying data sets that we work on. And so really, most of the people in my lab, there's really three people who work on this pipeline, but everyone else is dealing with data and trying to take all of that data and use it to understand a lot of basic questions about the biology of plants, but then more also how we can use those that information to improve crops. So this is sort of really the underlying assumption of why we are trying to understand this process, is that if you're thinking about the elemental composition of a seed or a leaf tissue, it's really a function of the interaction between the plant and its environment. And so soil composition obviously has a huge effect. Environment in terms of temperature, rainfall, and how much water you're actually going to move through the plant to get to your seeds has a huge effect on your elemental composition. And then obviously things that we are very hard to measure, root structure and interactions with microbiota in the environment are going to also have big effects. So we think of the elemental profile of these above ground tissues as a readout of all of those processes come together. And so the question for us is, can we use that readout to understand these processes even if we're not measuring the individual below ground? And so a lot of what we do is genetics, but also looking at environmental factors and trying to pull out correlations that can explain what's going on. So let me start with one experiment that we've done, and then we'll sort of branch out past that. So this is work over many years that we've been doing, looking at IBM population in maize, which is a very well-studied population, and so we've been able to get seed from lots of different growouts, including sort of paired growouts from different years from the same farm, and run that through the pipeline. It's a not a huge data set as compared to some of our other mapping sets, but it's still 154,000 data elements. And so Allie, the grad student, has just had her first paper about to come out in G3 on this analysis, and then the second paper we're working on. I spent a lot of time trying to think about how we treat this data. The simplest one is QTL mapping, looking for markers. And when you do this individually across all the different grow outs, you get lots of different QTLs. Some of them show up in every environment. Those are really the minority, though. Most of the QTLs that we get seem to be location specific, and we spent a lot of time going back and forth trying to figure out what's a real location specific QTL and what is could be an artifact. And the bottom line is we're fairly convinced that most of these are real QTLs that are showing up in individual environments. The heritability analysis suggests that these are elemental traits are very heritable within an environment and not very heritable across environments, and that's fundamentally a gene by environment or genotype by environment interaction that's driving that. But that's really treating the traits as individual elements, and we know that because all these processes that are driving elements are linked, and that there are very few actual element-specific processes. And so this is something that we've been thinking about for a long time, going back to my postdoc in David Salt's lab when we started cloning mutants in Arabidopsis. And we found a lot of these mutants that, if you look across the elements, they're multi-element phenotypes. And so this is a single gene knockout that we mapped, and then we have tDNA alleles that we've confirmed. And this gene is involved in suberin biosynthesis in the root, and you alter it and you get differences in calcium all the time, and then a couple other elements that you see in some traits and some elements that you see in other traits. And this goes back to the point I was making before. These traits are very responsive to the environment they're grown at. You can always tell that this line is a mutant when you compare it to wild type, but the actual elemental differences will vary depending on the environment. And so that means that you need to be thinking about all of these different connections as you're trying to wrap your head around what the traits are actually doing as you go across environments. So this is a diagram. This is now very old, but I made this in 2009, and each arrow indicates a known strong interaction between elements defined by being in a mutant or having a shared QTL architecture or being driven by a defined environmental contrast that we were able to track. And you can see it's a big mess. And that and which elements are correlated with which other elements changes across environments, across genetic populations, across species. And so we know that these are not 20 individual elements, but it's really hard for us to define what are the actual traits that we're looking at. And so this is sort of state-of-the-art questions in my mind, and is, should we treat the ionome as a combination of individual traits, or should we be trying to derive these novel traits that are multi-element? And how does that, and especially when you're trying to think about micronutrient improvement, I think that makes it very complicated for you to say, well, we want to increase iron, zinc, lower cadmium, increase, we want calcium high, we want phosphate to be as non-inflated. Those kinds of things are going to be very tough to tease apart if you don't sort of try and understand the whole picture and try and go back and understand that. So the nice thing is that this is a very, we've made this very high throughput, so it's not very expensive, so it's fairly easy for us to do large experiments to go track these through. So they tell you not to start a headline, headline with a yes or no question, because the answer is always no. This is fortunately not a yes or no question, so we can just say and shrug our shoulders and move on. So one of the ways that we're trying to get at this is by looking at these sort of combined traits through principal component analysis, and we're not trying to reduce the complexity down when we do this. We're just trying to sort of twist the matrix of elements and find traits that may be driving multiple elements. And so when we did this on Allie's data set, the first two principal components are highly environmentally driven. So this is the 10 environments colored by environment, and you can see there's clear structure from the environment in the elemental traits. And it's not just growth location in terms of the farm. So two grow outs of Florida are clearly separated out. And so there are environmental variables within a farm, and it may be, some of that is might be going field to field, but it's also probably the amount of rainfall and those types of things. And so we're very interested in getting these sort of multi-environmental data sets together where we can start to track some of those variables. So the maize GDF project is something that we're in the middle of analyzing a lot of their samples because they have those very fine-grained environmental data that we're hoping to link in there. I will note that even for these principal components that are very highly affected by the environment, we can find QTLs. And we also find completely novel QTLs that for some of these principal components that don't overlap at all with elemental traits, at least that we can detect. And so underlying some of this transposed matrices are genetic variation driving combinations of elements that we wouldn't have seen if we looked just at the individual elements. When we try and bring that all together across these populations, some of the QTLs we only detect in the elemental set, some we only detect in the principal component set. And then there's this big overlap, and it's the numbers don't really matter because it's hard to say how many QTLs you have when you have a principal component trait overlapping. But the overall idea is that in both of these approaches, there's genetic variation we can try and understand, and we're still sort of struggling at how to get back at these and understand these traits overall. So obviously one of the best ways to be able to get this is to get to the underlying genes, and then you can sort of twist apart the function. That was one of the really nice things about that working with the Arabidopsis mutants, is that we could clone the genes easily and then confirm that, yes, these are elemental, multi-element traits that are very responsive to the environment. And so I'm going to really cut through like 4 to 5 years of work and just say that we've been working really hard using large, really powerful genetic populations that really awesome people have put together and then have shared their samples with us to map. And so we have mapping data in many different species and many different populations and across many different environments, and that's really most of those 250,000 samples is sort of contained in these experiments that we've done. And you know, we've had to really start wrestling with how we analyze all that data and bring it together. I will briefly mention that we developed our own GWASP browser that's interactive, easy to compare lots of traits across lots of environments, and bring things together. It's fully open source, and you can download it from the website. And people who use it seem to like it a lot. We use it all the time to think about these traits. One of the things that I wanted to tell you about in my last few minutes is sort of how we're trying to take the fact that we have all this data across multiple species and think about the fact that a lot of these processes, taking elements out of the environment and getting them up to the top of the plant and then using them, are probably very deeply conserved across a lot of plants. And so we wanted to say, can we take these data sets we have. And you know, a GWAS experiment is great. It gets you SNPs associated with your trait, and that's taking the full hay bale of the genome, and you get down to maybe a big armful of hay. But underneath the GWAS peaks, you still have lots of genes. And so one of the things we wanted to ask is, can we compare these sets of genes underneath GWAS peaks between these species and get potential genes that are coming up as conserved across all these experiments? And so we've tried a bunch of ways to do this. So and we have good GWAS sets from these four organisms. Some of them are very closely linked, and some of them are very distant. And so we've been developing tools to try and do this comparison. And as we do that, we come up with predictions, and then we realize how things could be wrong. And so we've got one version of this tool that we've built with iPlant using glass top hits. That was work with Matt Hudson and several people in his lab. And we got some interesting things there, but then we realized we needed a better way of building the database. We also needed to figure better ways to convince ourselves that the answers we're getting are at all meaningful. And so we needed to redo the architecture. And so we switched over to using Phytosome, which has already done all this sort of reciprocal cross-species blast. and then built an infrastructure that allows us to do permutations. And so that's what we're working on now. Liz Mahood is an undergrad. Has been helping Greg Ziegler, who's sort of the lead on this project in my lab, to do this second version, and where we can randomly build permutation data sets and redo and do this process 1,000 times. And when we take 4 data sets and do that, we get something like this. So what I'm showing you on the left, we've done a 4-way comparison looking for combined genes that are under each one, and then the output is you get a gene list in each species. And when we do the permutations 1,000 times, this is for iron, which everyone's interested in, and this didn't work so well. You get this is the distribution of permutations you get across 1,000, number of genes you get in each species across 1,000 permutations, and this is the number of genes we got with the actual data. And so you can see for iron, it looks like you randomly do this, and you get not very many things. For magnesium, you get looks to be a little bit better, depending on which species you're looking at. It doesn't work so good. But for zinc, we get a really good signal well above sort of our background distribution. So these are the ones we're going after to test the hypothesis that this is actually working. Is that 2 minutes? 4 minutes. Okay, good. So I think there's something there. This is a preliminary analysis. We're still trying to tweak it and figure out how we're doing. But I think this kind of signal suggests that there is underlying pathways and that this might be a valid approach for us to find genes that you wouldn't have predicted in key species, and then obviously if it works in one species, you would predict you've already cloned a gene in 4 different species. And we're also working to bring in other species, as you should be able to do anything that has a sequence in phytosome with this approach. So that's getting to the genes, and we're also working with networked approaches just within species, looking at gene networks, but I don't have time to talk about that. So I want to just close on one sort of completely different tack, which is much more of a physiological project, where questioning work that was done with Steve Huber and Randy Nelson from ARS, looking at the question of, does the position of a soybean seed in the canopy up and down matter for its composition? And basically, through years of looking at lots of years and lots of genotypes, a huge set of genotypes, and then splitting the canopy after harvest into the 4 quadrants, the answer appears to be that yes, there's a really strong effect of position. And so, both on the weight of a single seed, the middle of the canopy gets you stronger ones. You see a strong component of protein increasing as you go from the bottom of the canopy to the top, while its oil decreases. So these two are very positively and negative correlated. And when we look at the elemental composition, we see lots of different gradients. Some of them change. Calcium and strontium, it depended on which year. I mean, within each year, these are really significant, highly significant gradients. The strongest gradient was in iron. And I'm just showing you, so this is now every plot that we looked at across that large experiment. You see a strong 20% difference in the amount of iron going from the bottom to the top of the canopy. And that has, in terms of the nutritional content, that is a pretty strong effect. And so even simple things like position in the canopy can have a profound effect on components and we really don't understand what's driving this, but we think it has a lot of potential. For places where nutritional security is a big issue. I will say we think this is probably a phenomenon that you would see in any legume at least. We have some preliminary data that shows that. So we think that has a lot of potential, and we're still trying to figure out how to track it down. And so, just a quick conclusion, as I'm running out of time. We think that elemental composition is a great tool to understand gene by environment interactions. We're spending a lot of time developing new tools, and the soybean story I just told you about. And I would be loath to not talk about all the great people who did the work These are a small number of our collaborators. We really depend on many, many, many collaborators to do this. I'm funded, my core funds by ARS. The maze work that you saw was all funded by Plant Genome. And I didn't talk about our work with the DOE on Ziteria. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you. I would never say that this is the only approach. I just think there is clearly, my general statement is we are incredibly poorly knowledged about what genes actually matter in any species. And there's a bias in cloning, a very reasonable bias for people to want to clone genes that seem like they're very likely to work out. And so we don't go after the completely unknown genes. And so one of my big drivers in the tools we develop is I want us to be able to elevate and prioritize unknown genes that we can, to the point where it's a smaller subset that we can test. And this is one of those ways. So.
Thank you.